from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special report on a humanitarian crisis in the making on the Caribbean island of Hispaniola. As we've previously reported, some 200,000 people living in the Dominican Republic, many for several generations dating back to the late 1920s, almost all of them of Haitian descent and almost all of them black, have been declared officially stateless by the government in Santo Domingo. They face imminent deportation, mostly to Haiti. In September 2013, the highest court in that country ruled that people born after 1929 could only be guaranteed citizenship if they had proof that at least one parent held legal citizenship. Since the 1890s, hundreds of thousands of Haitians crossed the island to live in the Dominican Republic. Their children were Dominican citizens by birth until the 2013 Constitutional Court ruling, which denied their birth certificates and identity documents, leaving them stateless. The deadline to have their status officially recognized under a new process of application passed earlier this month, and those without official documentation, estimated to be at least 200,000 people, with the majority being of Haitian ancestry, are now being forced to leave. Sandra Honore, the head of the UN mission in Haiti, MINUSTAH, discussed the situation of those being expelled to Haiti with high-level Dominican officials during a recent visit to Santo Domingo. Honore also went to Haiti and discussed the situation with Haitian officials. She spoke with journalist Jorge Millares by telephone from Haiti.
I was in the Dominican Republic on the 17th of June within the framework of the consolidation and reduction of the United Nations Mission for Stabilization in Haiti. After the devastating earthquake in Haiti in January of 2010, MINUSTAH established a support office because many of our facilities were seriously damaged. So we have had a support office in the Dominican Republic, a small office, since then. And part of our reconfiguration and our consolidation involves the closure of six offices, regional and liaison offices in Haiti, and that small office in the Dominican Republic. So I was there for that purpose. I called on Foreign Minister Andres Navarro, and he was accompanied by a number of high-level immigration and other officials who raised the issue of the end of the period for registration in the National Plan for Regularization of Persons in Irregular Migration Status.
Has MINUSTAH made any kind of evaluation of what would be the direct impact in Haiti of a high returning rate of people from the Dominican Republic?
MINUSTAH has had discussions with the Haitian authorities. The Haitian authorities have also had discussions not only with MINUSTAH, but other agencies, funds, and programs of the United Nations working in Haiti. The effect of large numbers of persons along a border area at several points on the border where the Haitian government does not yet have facilities in place to receive and to process these people will in fact be a challenge for the government of Haiti.
Are there any provisions being taken regarding logistics in terms of housing, in terms of camps?
Yes, the government is looking at questions such as housing that will be required for those persons who do not have ready access to housing with family members or who do not have access to housing at all. At this stage, it is somewhat early, and I would prefer that that be a question that the government should deal with. But the government of Haiti does have a contingency plan, which it has developed to deal with this circumstance. Insofar as deportations are concerned, our appeal is that the deportation should be undertaken in a manner consistent with the dignity of persons, in a manner that respects human rights and international humanitarian law, and that deportation should not result in the deprivation of nationality of Dominican citizens of Haitian descent and contribute to the creation of situations where there are stateless persons.
Dr. Gerald Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. We spoke with him via Skype from Houston Thursday. Could you give us a little context for what's happening right now on the island of Hispaniola?
Well, in many ways, the island of Hispaniola represents the worst of European colonialism. You may know that Christopher Columbus himself first set foot on that island hundreds of years ago, and indeed in Santo Domingo, the capital city of the Dominican Republic, there are still statues in his honor, which is quite unfortunate given his role as a genocidal murderer. In any case, a turning point comes in the history of the island when what was then known as the two Catholic powers, that is to say Spain and France at the end of the 17th century, basically divide up the island, and Hispaniola rapidly becomes a tornado of exploitation. You know, of course, that on the eve of the revolution that swept through the western side of the island in circa 1791, the island had the reputation as being the richest colony, if not the richest piece of real estate on planet Earth. This was due, of course, to the maniacal exploitation of enslaved African labor after brutally and with malice aforethought, the indigenous population was subjected to genocide, a genocide that began when Christopher Columbus had landed on the island centuries earlier. It's also interesting to point out that North American mainland Europeans also had a role in this process. You know, of course, that when the United States revolted successfully against British rule in 1776, they were aided by the French colonialists and to a degree the Spanish colonialists who wanted to exact revenge against London because of their battles on the continent of Europe. As a result of that assistance, we find that U.S. slave dealers in the infant United States played a crucial role and helping to manacle, handcuff, and kidnap Africans and drive them across the Atlantic to the island of Hispaniola, which was quite profitable to the infant United States, helping to keep it afloat, and also was an emblem of the collaboration between the United States and France. When the Haitian Revolution erupts 1791 to 1804, U.S. nationals were massacred along with French colonialists, which helped to incur early on a great deal of wrath against the successful Haitian revolutionaries on the part of Euro-Americans in particular. This helps to shed light on the fact that the Haitian Republic, the leaders of the first successful slave rebellion, were not recognized diplomatically by the United States until the United States Civil War, when the United States itself was on the ropes being threatened by seditious rebellions by slave owners. And it's also striking to note that when Haiti is forced to pay reparations to the former French colonizers, many of these former French colonizers had decamped to New Orleans, which before the Civil War had more millionaires per capita than any other part of the United States of America. This rather dubious honor was due in no small part to the fact that black people in Haiti had to pay reparations to former slave owners who were then slave owners in Louisiana and New Orleans. This also helps to explain why in 1844, when the Dominican Republic rebelled against Haitian rule, that the United States was wholly supportive. In fact, as I suggest in my book that'll be out a couple of months from Monthly Review Press, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, there's evidence to suggest that this revolt against Haitian rule, which led to a splitting of the island, was engineered in no small measure by U.S. Secretary of State John C. Calhoun, who has been in the news lately because, of course, his roots are in South Carolina. He's considered South Carolina's favorite son. And, of course, he was oftentimes referred to as the Marx of the master class in the sense that he was the most hawkish and most resolute defender of enslavement of African peoples and saw the very existence of the Haitian Revolution as an insult to the slaveholding class. I should also mention in this context that at the time of the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, the island was still split between the French colonialists on the western side of the island and the Spanish colonialists on the eastern side of the island. The revolution sunk its deepest roots on the western side of the island. However, the Spanish continued to rule the eastern side of the island up until about 1822, when quite typically the Spanish monarchy was teetering. And as a result, the Haitians marched into the eastern side of the island and took over. Many of the Spanish slave owners then fled. They also fled largely to New Orleans, although some fled to Cuba, which was then a slave state under Spanish rule. And what happens then is that the Haitians decide to try to attract Black Americans to the eastern side of the island, and they come in the thousands, particularly to Puerto Plata on the northern side of what is now the Dominican Republic, and Samaná, which is also on the northern side of the Dominican Republic. So these Black Americans are basically pro-Haiti, but when the Dominican Republic declares its independence circa 1844, these Black Americans then, of course, are seen as enemies of the state. Because what happens beginning in 1844 is a bitter war leading to the killing of thousands between the DR and Haiti. And many Black Americans, of course, were supporting Haiti, and many of them, of course, were massacred as well. Strikingly enough, the DR was so fearful of Haiti, and one of the most remarkable developments in world history, in about 1860, the independent DR agrees to be voluntarily colonized by the Spanish, who then return to the island. But what happens is that that is not very popular amongst all Dominicans, particularly amongst darker-skinned Dominicans who fear that with the return of the Spanish, that slavery, which had been abolished by the Haitians throughout the island, would be returned, or minimally, that the darker skin would be shipped ignominiously to Cuba, which was then still a slave state. So what happens is, in the midst of the U.S. Civil War, is a bitter conflict, a civil war in the Dominican Republic between many Dominicans and the Spanish and the Spanish supporters on the island, with the Haitians supporting the Dominicans who were fighting the Spanish. This leads to a significant depopulation of the Dominican Republic because a lot of the war was fought on their soil and territory. Ultimately, what happens is that the Spanish are driven out of the Dominican Republic, but at that point, the United States decides it would be a neat idea to annex the island of Hispaniola, to take it over, and then deport the newly freed enslaved Africans from the North American mainland en masse to Hispaniola. Sadly enough, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist leader, is amongst those who's supporting this harebrained scheme. And it's only defeated barely, circa 1871, not least because of the leadership of Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. And of course, there's an avenue to this day in Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, named after Senator Sumner, just like there's an avenue named after the great abolitionist hero John Brown on the island, in Haiti. With the failure of the annexation, what's striking is that the Dominican leadership, and this is a tendency that lasts from the failed annexation 1870-1871, let's say at least up to 1941, if not beyond, of seeking to whiten the population of the island. That is to say that the Dominican Republic was seeking desperately to attract European migrants to the island. Indeed, during the 1930s, when you had European Jewish populations fleeing because of the rise of fascism and Nazism, one of the few places that they were allowed to enter was the DR. Not because the DR under the leadership of then dictator Rafael Trujillo was progressive, but they had this maniacal idea of seeking to whiten the island, and therefore, if the only people who were willing to come and live on this island were Jewish, well, then so be it. What that reveals and exposes is an underlying tension on the island to this very day. That is to say, one of the many reasons why today, in 2015, you have the government of the DR seeking to expel many dark-skinned citizens who they say are Haitian, even though many of them only speak Spanish, and many of them have roots on the island going back 2, 3, 4 generations, is because of this rather crazed obsession with being African and being dark-skinned, which is ascribed to the neighbor that they share the island with, that is to say the Haitians. In other words, ipso facto, according to Dominican elites, if you're dark-skinned, that probably means you're a Haitian. And in fact, this claim has been used repeatedly in internal Dominican politics, not least to try to destabilize the effort to elect progressive leadership. Now, of course, people in the United States should not necessarily see that as being alien, since you can say the same thing about U.S. politics. That is to say, we know that the Republican Party, which controls Congress, is basically the party of whiteness, even though we also know that previously it was the Democratic Party that was the party of whiteness. But after the presidents Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson started moving to try to appeal to black voters, like those who are defined as white who move out of neighborhoods when the first black person moves in, many of the whites started fleeing the Democratic Party in the 1960s when the Democratic Party started making these overt appeals to black voters, encapsulated in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and then defected en masse to the Republican Party. So in some ways, you can see the Dominican Republic as being a mirror reflection of the politics of the United States, which is not surprising given the origins of the Dominican Republic in a revolt against abolitionist Haiti in 1844, a revolt engineered in no small part by then Secretary of State John C. Calhoun, which helped to create a mirror image republic in the Caribbean designed to torment abolitionist Haiti.
So you have the thing that happened in the 1960s after Trujillo and up to Johnson's invasion and occupation of the Dominican Republic. How does that fit into this picture?
Well, it's very interesting. My reading is that just like in the United States, where you have a black population that votes against the right wing 9-1 and therefore is seen understandably and correctly by the right wing, the white right, as public enemy number one. In the DR, you have a population that oftentimes is depicted as Haitian, that oftentimes leans to the left, and therefore, after the Cuban Revolution of 1959, and the news began to be reported from Cuba about how the revolutionary regime was trying to tear down the walls of Jim Crow, which the United States occupation forces had implemented beginning in 1898. And when you had this upsurge in support for the revolutionary regime in Havana, there was a real fear that the Cuban Revolution would then spread to the DR itself. In fact, there was a real fear that it would spread hemispherically. Of course, another story can be told about the relations between Guyana on the northern coast of South America, a former British colony, and how that regime under Chetty Jagan is destabilized because of a fear that it's too close to Havana. and how in 1965, when U.S. Marines arrive in the thousands in the DR to engage in regime change, there's this like-minded fear that what they are seeking to block and obstruct is a revolutionary government, at least this is the perception, that is sympathetic to Havana, and also, which in many ways amounts to the same thing, not unsympathetic to black people. So I think in order to understand the politics of the DR, you have to understand the politics of Cuba and the politics of the mainland government in Washington, D.C.
So maybe we could look at if the relationship, basically how these the racial politics played out in Cuba in relation to the United States. Because you said before that the Spanish retained slavery there. And the Spanish were there until 1898. So what happens, say, from the time the DR is reacquired by Spain down to the time the United States takes over in Cuba? What's happening in Cuba?
Well, what's happening in Cuba is, number one, you had a, as I say in my book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba before slavery and Jim Crow, that you had many so-called Euro-Cubans who came to the North American mainland to fight to maintain slavery in Dixie. They came in considerable numbers. But at the same time, they should have been watching their own backyard, because after the defeat of the so-called Confederate States of America, what erupts in Cuba is what's called the 10 Years' War, 1868 to 1878, which is not only a war against Spanish colonialism, it's a war against enslavement. In fact, one of the differences between Cuba and the United States, and to a certain degree between the hemisphere and the United States, is that on the North American mainland, the struggle against slavery and the struggle against British colonialism are at loggerheads. There's a contradiction between the two. In fact, as I say in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, in many ways, the revolt against British rule in 1776 was a revolt against British abolitionism, which helps to shed light on why black people to this very day are still getting it in the neck in the United States, as exemplified by the recent Charleston massacre, and have had to rely upon friends and colleagues in the international community to rescue us from this hellhole now known as the United States of America. So in the person of Antonio Maceo, a Cuban national hero, and by the way, in a very positive development, a statue to Antonio Maceo was just restored in Little Havana in Miami. It had been desecrated in recent years, not least because, of course, of the reactionary attitudes, I'm afraid, of too many Cuban Americans in Miami, but in a positive sign in light of this approaching normalizing of relations between Washington and Havana, the statue has just been restored. But in any case, back to Cuba, the revolt against Spanish rule after the U.S. Civil War, it has positive aspects, which is to weaken slavery, which then is abolished in Cuba in the 1880s. But at the same time, as the Cubans and the Spanish are slugging it out, the United States sees an opportunity to accomplish a longstanding goal. Recall that one of the reasons, one of the many reasons for the U.S. Civil War, is that Jefferson Davis, who winds up being a leader or the president of the so-called Confederate States of America, but before 1860 was a senator, says that he wants to revolt against Washington because Washington won to annex Cuba and turn it into another U.S. slave state, or even divide it up into three or four slave states. Of course, many in the United States were opposed to that because they felt it would give too much of an edge in Congress to the slave states, such as Jefferson Davis's own Mississippi. So what happens as the Cubans and the Spanish are slugging it out, Washington seizes the opportunity to step in and knock out both and then take over, which they do circa 1898, and then seek to try to install their peculiar folkways, Jim Crow and rigid segregation, apartheid-like laws, not least, which, with all the failures and omission of Spanish colonialism, it's fair to say that this was a radical new development for Cuba when you have the implantation of these apartheid-like laws, which leads to a bubbling revolt against U.S. domination on the island, culminating in the so-called race war of 1912, which in my book I characterize as a revolt in the first apartheid-like laws the United States is seeking to impose, and a revolt against U.S. hegemony. This leads a few years later to the organizing of the of what becomes the Cuban Communist Party. And what's interesting is that the leaders of this party in its first years up until the 1950s were almost all Africans, which gives the idea, once again, of this confluence between blackness and radicalism, which becomes an obsession for Washington to eliminate. And so, as I suggest in my book, what happens in the 1950s is that Washington was so obsessed with what they perceive to be the twin evils, if you like, a blackness and redness, a blackness and communists, that they take their eye off the ball. And they're so busy trying to repress the precursor of the Cuban Communist Party led by Africans that it creates sort of a vacuum that allows the July 26th movement under the leadership of the Castro brothers to gain traction. And then they come to power January 1st, 1959. And then there's a merger between the July 26th movement and the old Communist Party, leading to the present day Cuban Communist Party, which has been a burn to the saddle for Washington since 1959, and also has been perceived as a force that will destabilize U.S. interests on the eastern side of the island of Hispaniola, that is to say the Dominican Republic.
Haiti is, of course, in the worst condition that it's ever been. It's been kept impoverished for much of the time since the revolution in the early 19th century. And the earthquake, of course, left devastation in its wake and UN occupation and disease. What do you see happening to the people that are, you know, being kicked out?
Well, it's tragic and very unfortunate, but I do think that militant action, particularly at Dominican consulates in the United States, such as in New York, Dominican Embassy in Washington, D.C., could help to influence the authorities in Santo Domingo to move in another direction. You are correct to suggest that Haiti continues to be punished for having the gumption to not only revolt against slavery, but then to extend the hand of friendship to its brothers and sisters on the North American mainland. Denmark Vesey has been in the news of late because of his premier role in the revolt against slavery in Charleston, South Carolina, which was hatched in the church, Mother A.M.E. Emanuel Church, which was torched after he and about three dozen of his Confederates were hung. And then, of course, we all know what happened in that church just a few days ago. But Denmark Vesey, part of his plot was to escape en masse with black people to Haiti. He, of course, had experience with Haiti going back to his days as a seaman. And so as a result of Haiti's stellar, stalwart role as a bulwark against slavery, it has been punished repeatedly. That's one of the reasons the United States helped to support France in extracting reparations from Haiti to the slave owners, many of whom were living in New Orleans. That helps to explain why the U.S. Red Cross collects millions, supposedly to build houses for Haitians after the earthquake, but we're still waiting for those houses to be built.
Right.
That's why serious allegations have been put at the doorstep of the Bill and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation for its misdeeds in Haiti, with Bill Clinton being a kind of viceroy appointed unilaterally to preside over Haiti. This is all evidence of this punishment of Haiti, a punishment that is proceeding as we speak, this time at the behest of the authorities in Santo Domingo.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.